this is Carol Thompson.
Hello, this is Fatboy Slim.
Hey, this is Alain, and you're listening to BCFM 93.2.
In the Bible, we're told that Eve was tempted by Satan to eat of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. God had commanded Adam and Eve not to eat of the fruit of that tree. If you do, ye will surely die. Isn't that the commandment? Lucifer, through his agent Satan, on the other hand, told Eve, God lied to you. He's holding back the fact that you too can become God.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Trade war with China. Is this Trump saber-rattling? Does he understand what China can do to the US economy if they want to hit back? And vaccines. We take a look at some of the reasons people, particularly young mums, don't trust them. Is there any substance to the claims? And we have a listen to part of the latest talk on measles by the discredited Dr. Andrew Wakefield. And some evidence of the biggest epidemic in modern human history, Spanish flu, at the end of the First World War, which killed more people than the war itself, was in fact a US vaccine test that went horribly wrong, but was covered up with the help of wartime censorship in everywhere except Spain, hence Spanish flu. And giants of the global elite, Peter M. Phillips from Sonoma University in California. His new book gives names and addresses to the people destroying our planet with greed for more and more and more money. He fingers a secretive Washington group of 30 as the Executive Committee of Global Capitalism. That needs to be exposed and broken if the world's to stand a chance. A chance against the threats of global economic war and climate disaster. These are the people responsible for it all, according to him, and most of them, despite the mass media, we've never heard of. Sister show Dialects here on BCFM on Tuesday at noon. This week, the Bristol China Bureau exists to foster trade links between China and the southwest of England. Their chief executive is Diane Frankham. We have a full interview, which we played a bit of on here last week, with former Washington Post journalist turned aid worker Stephen Landrigan, who accumulated a dossier of facts and figures about the misspending of donor money in Afghanistan by Tory MP Rory Stewart, who was, up until last week, also a leadership contender. You can listen here on BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download it right now from dialectradio.co.uk. But we start, Martin, with the G20 discussing in Osaka, Japan, and apparently tomorrow morning there's going to be a conversation between President Xi and Donald Trump. How do you think that's going to go over tariffs?
Well, I've been reading about this afternoon. It's pretty clear there's not going to be any kind of deal about it, and therefore the stuff I've been saying is predicting a stock market crash, because they basically the stock market, Wall Street.
Not another crash.
I'm afraid so, no, but I mean, I'm just telling you, because a lot of this is out there. The market has priced in some kind of deal. They believe that Trump and the Chinese have got so much to lose that they will come to some arrangement, and the market has already priced that in. Now, if it becomes absolutely clear that nothing is going to happen on this front, and it looks as if it won't, because both sides are way far apart, then that could undermine the stock market completely. I'm not saying it's going to happen, I'm just saying that's what I was reading this afternoon.
So what could the Chinese do?
Well, the obvious thing that in the past they used to say that what they could do is sell US treasuries, but they don't really want to do that because that crashes their own economy. What the Russians have had to do since sanctions were put off on them after the Ukraine crisis and all the rest of it is they've had to remodel their economy to make it less vulnerable to external shocks. Now, the Chinese basically bought into the idea that they should be interdependent with the American economy, and that would make them both, you know, basically that would be the future. It's now becoming clear that that's not necessarily going to be the case. But don't forget, China's got big resources. For example, they've got rare earth metals and stuff, which the Americans haven't gotten. They're totally dependent on them. And a trade war on both sides would create a massive economic hit for both sides. So there is lots of incentive for them not to do it. But on the other hand, this is geopolitics at the highest level. The Americans are not prepared to let the Chinese overtake them in the economic stakes, and therefore they're doing everything they can to nobble them now before they get too big for their boots.
What about if China starts dumping US debt? How would that affect?
Well, what they could do quite easily is they could dump US debt, and that would crash the US stock market. But if they did that, they lose a lot of money.
Hang on, how does that actually work?
Well, basically, the US are allowed to run a massive.
It make it more difficult it more difficult for US firms to borrow. It more expensive.
Yeah, but they'd have to raise interest. I mean, basically, it would make the dollar cheaper if they sell it. Although, in actual fact, there's a lot of pressure that keeps the dollar up. So I don't think the Chinese are going to do that. Actually, what they're going to do, I think, is they're going to start selective trade sanctions. So what they've done so far is they've looked at where Donald Trump's support is, and they've targeted those areas like the soybeans. Soybean farms in the US sell loads of soybeans to the Chinese. And they're all going bankrupt, and the American taxpayer is picking up the tab.
But at the end of the day, Donald Trump did get elected on this ticket, didn't he?
No, he didn't.
He did. He said he's going to increase tariffs in order to protect US businesses. That's what he said he'd do.
No, he said in a general sort of a way he did say that, but he didn't specify what he was actually going to do. And therefore, you can't say he's got a mandate to do this.
Well, he did talk about China. He talked about steel, for example.
Basically saying that the idea of trying to manage China by cooperating with them, we're going to give up on that. And of course he can do that, and many people in America think that's a good idea, but they may find out that it's not such a good idea because it's basically going to World War III. And of course what they're doing
Hang on, why does a trade war suddenly turn into World War III?
Because that's what world wars are about, Tony. It's about controlling the world market, and ultimately that is going to be a shooting war for control of the South China Sea. At minimum.
I mean, surely what happens is you get trade barriers and the Chinese will start dealing more with other countries that are not America, and they just have to say, well, okay, so the US market is not a market anymore.
The Chinese are trying to set up through the One Belt, One Road initiative, a kind of Marshall Plan for the developing world.
Well, the interesting thing about that is that it's a train line, isn't it? Which actually
it's not just train lines, it's all sorts of things, but train lines includes 5G, actually.
One of the main things is the train line bringing goods into Europe and under the Channel Tunnel, for example, much quicker than the ships can do.
Well, exactly, and the point is you can move it. They're trying to create interconnectivity and build infrastructure in relatively poor regions so that the whole world economy becomes integrated on what they would call a market socialist basis.
I mean, ultimately,
but the Americans are not happy with that at all.
Ultimately,
they basically run the roost since 1945. The Americans have the privilege of being able to print as many dollars as they like, and the value of their currency remains high because everybody has to have dollars. So the real struggle is to de-dollarize the world economy. And of course, that's beginning to happen as the Russians and the Chinese set up, payment systems where they don't have to use the dollar, etc.
So, what's the relationship between that and the IMF, the US and the IMF? Because it does seem to be quite a US dominated.
Well, it is. I mean, the IMF was set up, and the US dominates the board of it. It's the people, the IMF, the funding structure of the IMF is various countries pay in, and then they become the board of the IMF.
This is the International Monetary Fund. It was set up at the Bretton Woods Conference
in 1944.
At the end of World War II.
Yeah.
So what's wrong, if anything, with the IMF? Does it really
Well, the IMF is basically a debt collector for the Western banks and multinationals. That's what's wrong with it. It goes into countries and says, oh, you're in trouble. Well, you can have a loan from us, but first you've got to do X, Y, Z, privatise this, deregulate that, blah, blah, blah. And it's called the Washington Consensus, and they've been doing it for years. And of course, they never do it to themselves. The American budget deficit is by far the most egregious of on the planet. But nobody slaps them over the wrist and says they've got to get it down.
I mean, if it's
that'd have to be the Martians, wouldn't it?
If it's unpayable debt the US has got, how come they can continue to survive? Surely they should just financially collapse. Like
No, because if you've got a situation where you've got military force out there paid for by your budget deficit, which then forces people to trade with the dollar, if a country tries to get out of that, look what's happened to Venezuela.
So this is a little bit like the way the Royal Navy used to operate.
Well, it's basically imperialism,
as
outlined by J.A. Hobson and V.I. Lenin
so
and
didn't
various
pay
others.
Your debts, the Royal Navy would turn up on your doorstep.
Well, that's what happened in Turkey, that's
shooting,
what happened in Egypt, that's what happened in China. And of course, that's the way the world works. The core of the capitalist economy in the West has basically dominated everybody else to the rest's detriment for 200 years.
He used to work,
not necessarily going to carry on that much longer.
He used to work for the Chase Manhattan Bank. His name is Michael Hudson. And here he is on a recent edition of the US radio program Guns and Butter, talking about what he sees as the IMF as an ex-insider.
When I went to work on Wall Street in the 60s, I was balance of payments economist for Chase Manhattan, and we would use the IMF's international financial statistics, and at the very top of each country, there would be the exchange rate, and the countries would have two exchange rates, one exchange rate, which was set normally by the market for goods and services, but then a different exchange rate that was managed for international capital movements, and that was because countries were trying to prevent capital flight of their, that is, they didn't want the wealthy classes to essentially make a run on their own currency, which is something that happened continually in Latin America. The IMF and the World Bank both backed the cosmopolitan classes, the wealthy classes, and essentially, instead of having countries control their capital outflows and prevent capital flights, the IMF said, well, our job is to protect the richest 1% of every country. So when a country's having trouble in a balance of payments problem, when it's trade deficit that the World Bank has sort of steered them into and American diplomacy has steered them into, when that's creating a currency crisis, we have to let the rich people get their money out of the country in a hurry. So we're going to make a loan to Argentina or Brazil or whatever country to support the currency until all of the wealthy people have moved their money out of domestic currencies into the dollar or into hard currencies, and then we'll let the currency collapse after the rich people have gotten out. The currency will collapse, but since the debts that these countries, Latin American countries, owe are in dollars, they now have to pay twice or even three times as much. We're talking about 100% interest rates in domestic currency for these countries to pay, basically to subsidize capital flight. So when you have a hyperinflation, as Chile had, for instance, early on, all hyperinflations of Latin America, just like Germany after World War I, come from trying to pay foreign debts beyond the ability to be paid. Now, a real international monetary fund that was trying to help countries develop would have said, okay, banks and we, the IMF, have made bad loans to the country. We've made loans that the country can't pay, so we're going to have to write down the loans to the ability to be paid. That's what happened in 1931 when finally the world stopped German reparations payments and inter-allied debt stemming from World War I. Well, the IMF said, we want to prevent any move by other countries to bring the debt volume within the ability to be paid. We want to use debt as essentially America would use its military power. We want to use debt and credit as a means of controlling the lifeline of other countries. So if countries do something that we don't approve of, we can simply make a run on their currency. We can pull the plug financially, just as the United States has recently threatened to do to Russia and China if they act independently of the United States or simply don't follow orders. So from the very beginning, this control by the U.S. banking system was built into the world system by the IMF and the World Bank, claiming to be international instead of an expression of American nationalism. Any country that really was self-reliant and was promoting its own economic interest would have said, you banks have made bad debts, we're not going to pay. And they would have seized the capital flight of their comprador elites and said, look, this has been a ripoff by our corrupt ruling class. You had exactly the same thing happen in Greece a few years ago when Greece's foreign debt was almost all owed to Greek millionaires holding their money in Switzerland. And all of this was published by the IMF, and the IMF said, our loyalty is to the Greek millionaires who have their money in Switzerland. The Greek economy will have to pay. It's worth wrecking the Greek economy. It's worth forcing emigration. It's worth wiping out Greek industry just so the 1% who are our loyalists can be paid. This is what makes the IMF so vicious an institution.
Martin, that's Michael Hudson there, former banker from the Chase Manhattan Bank, and he's been writing for several years now about, as an insider really, saying things like the richest 1%, as he's saying there, are almost like a kind of pirate force working for the IMF within each country against that own country's interest, against the government's interest.
Well, he's not just he's an insider from Chase Manhattan, but he's also an academic economist in the university. He's a retired university professor. Well, yes, I mean that's the way the world works, and that's what's been going on for years and years and years, and it's absolutely blatant. And it's not got any better, it's got worse.
Okay, so debt as a military force. Now, he's starting to connect up with what you were saying previously with the Chinese, isn't he?
Yeah, of course it is. I mean, basically, the US aspiration is to run a one-world system with them at the top of the pile and everybody else basically integrated into their financialized way of doing things, which is ultimately a parasitic it's a parasitic setup, and it stifles development in developing countries, which you've got the Chinese are trying to break out of, saying, well, we'll give you long-term loans to invest in infrastructure, which will improve your productivity so that ultimately everybody can benefit, which is pretty much what the US did in Western Europe after World War II.
Here in Britain, are we going to simply have to do what the United States says?
We always do. I mean, when have we not done what the United States...
For example, with the under David Miliband, with the attack on Ed Miliband under the attack on Syria.
Well,
we can't just say we're total 100%
battle
state.
No, we're not 100%, and we've got every opportunity. We've got some opportunities to speak up. But Jeremy Hunt, as we were talking about earlier, has already promised us to go to war with Iran if Trump decides to go.
What about financially with the City of London? Will the City of London put itself at jeopardy with China?
No. Well, the point is, the City of London is part of the IMF game. And up to now, people have been allowed to do deals with China because the IMF, or rather the ruling class in the US that runs the IMF, has said, well, it's okay to do business with China, which is why Apple set up over there. And you know, we set up all of these production facilities, etc. It's very profitable for them. But, of course, suddenly they've changed their minds because China's becoming too much of a threat. Therefore, we're going to confront them. But they make the decision. The decision to confront China or not confront China isn't taken by the British, it's taken by the Americans, and we just fall into line.
So we're telling our businesses, yes, it's okay to have factories in China, that sort of thing. Now, all of a sudden, we seem to be turning in the opposite direction.
Yes, basically. And the Chinese are pretty... The Chinese
will the British push back? Is what the point I'm trying to get.
Will the British push back? No. Not in the immediate circumstances, because we're obsessed with Brexit and breaking with the EU, which again is a one faction of US capitalist
policy.
Okay,
so will the Germans push back then?
Well, the Germans ought to push back, because the Americans...
Will they? Never mind ought to.
No, well, in the short run, the answer is no, because the system is rigged. The politicians who are in power in Germany are all basically there as a result of...
So Trump is in the middle of a fait accompli, pretty much, but anyone that wants to react to it is going to have to deal with it afterwards.
What's happening with Trump is that basically the Americans used to twist arms and, you know, crush testicles behind the scenes, but they weren't that obvious about it. The people who knew were being threatened knew they were being threatened, you know, the economic hitman Perkins and all the rest of it, but they basically made a front of trying to help everybody and being reasonable. What Trump's done is he's come straight out front like a mafia boss and said, you do this, you do this, you do this, and I'm not listening to any arguments. And of course, in the long run, or even in the medium term, people are shocked by all of that because they're expecting to be treated with some respect, but ultimately it's going to undermine American power completely, and there's going to be a cataclysmic collapse of the American empire, which is not going to be fun at all.
Okay, well, it's a topic that I broached with Peter Phillips from Sonoma University in California this week. His book Giants, the Global Power Elite by Peter Phillips came out at the tail end of last year, and he is particularly concerned about something called the Council of 30, which have got many powerful bankers involved. He talks about them as the executive committee for global capitalism.
The most central, most powerful group of people are the Council of 30, the G30, and they're based in Washington, D.C. There's 32 people, two women. Bernanke is there, Carney is there, people from Europe, William Dudley from Bank for International Settlements is there. Those 32 people are the Executive Committee of Global Capitalism. Roger Ferguson, Thomas Geithner, Jacob Finkel from U.S. Israel American International Group. Gail Kelly is one of the few women there. She's Australian and part of the Bankers Association of Australia. Philip Hildebrand from Switzerland is chair, former chair of the Swiss National Bank, and now is chair of BlackRock in that. Paul Krugman is there as one of the world's economists. So these are the people in the top 30 of in what's called the Group of 30. Former president of Mexico, the Chinese construction bank Zhao Zuochun is there. So they are a very centralized advisory group that puts out reports with private money that is seen as instructions for the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and literally governments where we should be going, and intelligence agencies.
He just throws that in at the end there, Martin. Intelligence agencies too involved in this.
Well, yeah, there would be. I mean, when you said that we hadn't heard of them, I'd heard of several of those people, and some of them are actually international bureaucrats.
Well, you've heard of them, but what I'm saying is they're certainly not people you would see generally scrutinised by the UK TV, radio networks, even the newspapers.
No. There are overlapping networks of power in the global power elite. There definitely is a global power elite, there's no doubt about that. But and there are basically inner and outer elites, if you can imagine. You know, there are very, very important people, there are less important people, and there are very minor people who generally tend to do as they're told. It's like watching chimpanzees, you know, that's what you expect to see and that's what you get.
He also explained to me what he thinks these people believe. What is it actually drives them? Have they got some sort of motivating force, like a kind of religion?
They believe that growing capitalism will trickle down and benefit the entire world. That simply isn't happening. 80% of the world lives on less than $10 a day. Half the world lives on $3 a day. So what's happening is this continued concentration of wealth in a very small number of people that is continuing to grow, and at the expense and the harm to everyone else, and to the environment, and to war, and to, you know, possible extinction of the human race. So we have to multiple things. I mean, there's resistance ongoing worldwide, the Bolivarian revolts, the workers' movements in China, the student movements in Italy and Spain, resistance in Greece. I mean, there's public resistance movements to all of this centralized capital worldwide, which is part of the reason they have NATO and the U.S. military empire as the police force globally to protect global capitalism. But it's inevitable. They can't continue to concentrate wealth and without eventual threat of collapse. Collapse because of capital collapse and or collapse because of the environment. It's a very dangerous game, and war is always a possibility. And so that danger, that possibility, inevitability of human catastrophic wars, environmental collapse, and civil unrest is going to happen unless they make change to share that wealth on a global scale. And that's what we're saying, that we want them to implement the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and we're going to pressure them to do it. Social movements are pressuring them to do that. And by identifying who they are, that's what this book is about. Here are the 389 people who could do something about this.
Well, I think the analysis is pretty sound. But, I mean, the 389 people who might do something about it, I mean, they're not going to do anything about it because they're the ruling class. I mean, they could, but they won't. Although, in actual fact, you see, people like Krugman are centrist leftist economists, who's mentioned as one of the Council of 30 or whatever it is, and they do agonise. At Davos, they frequently agonise about how unfair the world's becoming and how unequal it is, but they just can't do anything about it. It just never seems to actually turn into any kind of policy to do anything.
Well, the main problem with this, of course, is that there's no proper scrutiny. Why is it that the press don't look at these? I mean, these people are actually driving the levers of global capitalism, driving the levers of climate change, the levers of war, the levers of economic repression, of poverty. Why is it that there isn't so little scrutiny by the mass media?
Because they control the mass media. That's what they, you know, they make plans, they make long-term plans, and they control the mass media. They control the New York Times, they indirectly control the BBC, they certainly control the Sun, etc., etc. And that's why most people get their news.
They don't control you and me yet, and they don't control Peter Phillips. And here he is explaining what he thinks the point of his book is.
My goal of this book is to identify those people who are in charge, and that we need to get in their face, so to speak. And that actually does work. Jamie Dimon, who was chair of J.P. Morgan Chase, activists have been targeting him at his home and on the Upper East Side, and picketing there. Over the issue of private their investments in private prisons, and they got J.P. Morgan Chase to withdraw from investing in private prisons because they targeted him in his office. So he was willing to give up on private prison investment, and I go, well, okay, how about giving up on investing in Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman and Boeing? But that's not the issue at this point. But the issue is that we can identify them and pressure them to make decisions that are correct for humanity.
It does make you wonder, doesn't it, whether they're going to take some sort of cataclysm before these people wake up, Peter?
I certainly hope not. That's why we have to identify who these people are. And so instead of just saying, oh, it's Bezos and it's Gates and it's, you know, it's not. The network is very clear, and that's the book is about the global power elite as a sociological network.
Well, I may be interested to have a look at the book, because I think that we do not really understand how the global elite works. We know it's there, we can feel its effects, but who exactly is involved and how powerful each individual component is you know, I mean...
Well, surely it's a system.
It's a system, but with individuals, all in actor network theory in the universities, a system is always enacted through individuals and through physical structures. Yeah, it's not just an abstract thing. There are always individuals involved.
I mean, one of the biggest people exposing this, I mean, it's not the mass media, it's been, amazingly enough, Oxfam. It's interesting to see them coming under a lot of media attack recently.
Well, I mean, their
report says there are fewer than 200 super connected asset managers at only 17 asset management firms, each with well over $1 trillion in assets. assets that they personally manage. They now represent the financial core of the world's transnational capitalist class.
Well, I think those who study this stuff at university level are very well aware that this is what goes on. It's just very difficult to do anything about it because they're incredibly powerful. They've got enormous resources, which basically a lot of them are stolen. Don't forget, the banks should have been allowed to collapse if you're going to follow the free market.
You say they're enormously
textbook,
powerful, but they weren't. They do seem to invest, and they invest in organisations which will, anybody that's out there criticising them or taking notice of them, people like Peter Phillips here, they tend to look at ways that they can spend their money in order to marginalise people like him. I mean, in Oxfam's case, it's been pretty, I'm not saying that there's been quite a lot of controversy to do with Oxfam recently, to do with, I think it was in Haiti,
yeah,
some of their individuals there abusing children, something like
wasn't
that.
Wasn't abusing now, children, they were using prostitutes. They were ex-military personnel who'd been sent by Oxfam to Haiti to do, and Oxfam employs quite a lot of ex-military people, and they
but
do what
see,
many military type people do, they
have
sex with prostitutes.
No exposure of these 200 super connected asset managers and 17 asset management firms, no exposure of the group of 30 in Washington, for example.
Well,
it's Oxfam that gets it.
Yes, indeed. And Oxfam are commended for taking on that fight. But of course, they get then accused of being political, etc., etc. It's very tricky. These people are very powerful because they've got loads of resources. They've got financial resources, military resources, psychological warfare resources of extraordinary intensity, as we've discussed on this programme over the last 10 years plus. And it doesn't mean they're invincible, because they often make mistakes. And we were supposed to be invading 7 countries in 5 years, according to General Wesley Clark, but they haven't got through the 7 yet, because basically they got their noses bloodied on the way.
And also the Iranians, the Chinese, the Russians and many other countries are wise to what they're up to.
Yeah, in the past, when they had a more emollient face, the Chinese, the Russians, etc., thought, well, we can always do business with them. You know, we may not like what they're doing completely, but we can basically talk to them, they'll come to some arrangement. That is dissipating completely. People are beginning to feel that they're mad, that they don't really care about anybody else. I mean, when every time Trump goes America first, that means everybody else, well, that means we're not first at all, doesn't it? We're the exceptional country, all of that sort of stuff. It's going to provoke a reaction. And the reaction is going to be, and he said he doesn't want a cataclysm. I don't want one, but it's more than likely that's where this is going to end.
Why?
Because the forces at work, as in the run-up to the First World War, are so ingrained and so, you know, once you've built up all this weaponry and you've got a financial crisis which you've engineered because of your own stupidity and also because of your own greed, the composer Gustav Mahler, many years ago from Vienna, he said, greed and hypocrisy will always lead to war.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, it's George Orwell's birthday this week. Most years I try to get there. There's something called the 1984 Symposium that takes place this week. It was Tuesday over in Sutton Courtenay, where George Orwell's buried on his birthday. It's a get-together of various people who are Orwell fans. And I thought we'd have a listen now to a bit of a discussion that Christian Payne, who organises it, recorded with a bunch of us. And really, what we're doing, Martin, at this, and what Christian has decided to do with this, is to look at modern surveillance, modern technology, and how technology is being used against us. So let's have a little listen, and I'll put a link up to our show page to the full recording that was done there. But and he started by talking to someone who put an Eastern European perspective on what's going on now in the Western world.
You come from an academic background, Wojciech. What would Orwell have made of all of this, right?
Well, that's exactly what I was thinking about,
I will be wearing
my Eastern European hat incorrectly, talking about Poland, so Central European hat, and you know, I remember the times before the 1989 when the whole idea of having access to satellite TV and information coming from the other side of the Iron Curtain was so exciting, because we used to live, behind these walls of information of anything else. political control, etc. And we were sort of dreaming of that access to that information, which nowadays is for all to have. And so this is amazing, and it's, you know, we were full of optimism at that time. And today I feel it's more like the weather, you know, rather miserable, although it's clearing up at the moment. And what worries me, you know, looking at that from that perspective, is the compartmentalization of the internet. I mean, the fact that the Chinese have their own internet, that the Russians are thinking about building the same firewalls, and that the companies are involved. But I'm less concerned about their commercial power that they were going to use to sell their products. I'm more concerned by the fact that they will gain more political power and more political influence. So that's what worries me. I think as in 1989, you know, the walls were started to come down, now they're sort of reappearing and, you know, all over the place, and that's what worries me.
So can I go around everybody for one piece of either advice or a tip or a feeling on how we can deliver some first aid on this, or what best, I mean, if I say I think we need to be using more open web systems, we need to be using more open source software, we need to be using encryption that has been vetted. I really enjoy the fact that in the last few years I have pulled back into conversational spaces which don't see any advertisement, are completely, as far as I know, if I can trust the device and my threat level I believe is low enough for me not to worry about everything being scraped on point of entry, but it semi-private, let's say, conversations happening. And if it wasn't for me having my phone out right now, which is on airplane mode as I record this, and will be public, meetings like this. I've had more physical meetings in the last few years because I just want to get together face to face. I think all of this is healthier, not only for me, but I think for society. Anybody else want to add anything?
Books. Stop reading short form stuff that's of the moment, and read more long form books.
One of the things I miss about the old internet, if that's a term, is that it was more of a wild, wild west in terms of just find all kind of weird and wacky stuff. And yeah, you had to be careful about what you read, but you were able to find surprises. And I think people just want to go scroll on their Facebook and not actually come outside of Facebook to do anything. So if you were a blogger, I'm not going to go look for your blog. Mm-hmm. Even if it comes on Facebook, I'll see the headline, but I'm not going to click the link and go. So I guess I encourage people to, however you go about finding more weird stuff. There's tons of stuff out there.
This is a really good point, not wanting to turn this into an advertisement for, you know, my newsletter, but it really does make me go outside of my spaces, finding, curating and discovering stuff to throw into stuff like that. And that's why I subscribe to so many other newsletters as well. So
yeah, same. Yeah, I'm big into the newsletter bit.
So that was from George Orwell's graveside at Sutton Courtney in Oxfordshire on Tuesday, Martin. Really what I guess they're talking about there, we're talking about, is the beginning of the end of the internet. So a sort of disillusion with the way that the big tech giants have moved in, started to control such a lot. For example, Google taking over the news groups. That wasn't mentioned specifically, but that's what they've done. Much of the infrastructure is now controlled through these tech giants, and actually a lot of people's usage of the internet is through them, tech giants now. And what the discussion there really was saying was these tech giants, now they've got their monopoly type position or oligopoly position, they're now starting to abuse that. They're telling us what they want us to know, not what we want to know. So the beginning of the end of the internet.
Well, I mean, it's the evolution of the internet in that particular direction. And of course, they're not doing it just because they're greedy capitalists. It's also because they're in bed with the same people we were talking about in the previous section, the international capitalist elite.
You know what? We had exactly the same
of a dominant faction in had, everything.
We had exactly the same with television, didn't we? In the 1960s and 70s and maybe 80s, this was the golden age for TV. It then kind of got scraped up by people who wanted to use it to sell us a line. The internet's going in the same direction. They're saying there, for example, talking about the Chinese firewall, the Chinese setting up their own internet. The Russians now talking about doing the same.
Yeah, but, I mean, but the, it's not so much that they're doing that the internet is being reined back by the Chinese and the Russians. I mean, China in particular is an authoritarian state where they've always controlled information of the population. So there's nothing new there, really. One of the problems for authoritarian regimes is that they can't, in fact, control information flow in the way that they used to. But what they can do is engage in sophisticated psychological warfare operations where what you read on the internet is basically, it's not that it's not true, there has been a bomb attack, but it wasn't carried out by the people who you say it's carried it out, and the population can be herded in different directions by psychological warfare
just
techniques.
One example of that, the horrific attacks on Easter Sunday in Sri Lanka, the Sri Lankan internal inquiry has said that actually they don't believe ISIS was in any way involved in this, the specific ISIS, and they're saying that it was another very powerful, possibly state actor outside Sri Lanka. But we haven't heard that, have we? We haven't heard the information which was leaked in Lebanon, which said that the Saudis had sent a communique a week or so before that attack, telling their embassy staff to destroy a whole load of documents and also not to go anywhere near churches. And that was intelligence they didn't share with anybody in in Sri Lanka.
Yeah, but what can I say this? Before the internet, we wouldn't have known any of those things. And what we're actually dealing with is that psychological warfare has now become a very, very fast game.
Well, one of the fascinating things...
It's like ice hockey on speed.
About that specific story, and I should put a link up to it on our show page, because I tried to post the story of the leaked Saudi document in Lebanon on Facebook, and it says this breaches our community guidelines.
Well, in other words...
It wouldn't let me share it at all.
Yes, I know. So
Facebook is becoming
history,
really.
You've got these big corporations who are trying to use their power to basically pursue an agenda, but there's always a way around. I mean, the early days of the internet, it really was all, you know, people just finding out stuff independently and so on. And it's become more corporatized. But on the other hand, the actual radical internet still exists and is a threat to the powers that be. In 1948, when Orwell was writing, it was very difficult to get hold of information. You know, you read a newspaper which was written by people who weren't going to tell you very much, and they didn't know that much themselves. The big advantage of the internet, like the fact that this show goes out on the internet, it's not just broadcast on FM to the people of Bristol. Anybody can hear it in anywhere in the world as long as they click on the right link.
So ITV are actually doing some quite good documentaries. I tend to watch the ITV National News now because it's better than it's not quite as biased as the BBC News. And let's have a little listen now to one of the documentaries that ITV have been doing. They've started a new documentary strand, not quite up to the scale of World in Action, I'm afraid. There was a sort of... I suppose dismantling really of the major documentary series, the sort of documentaries that maybe today would have been looking into the Council of 30 we heard about from Peter Phillips now, Martin. Well, what happened?
Well, what happened is that because of the 1960s and 1970s, I mean, what's it, you know, the Jill Scott Heron song, you know, first one wants freedom and the whole damn world wants freedom. And of course, they decided that they were going to rein all that in. And they have. They've changed completely, for example, the power of trade unions in developed countries. In most countries, completely smashed. So that's a complete change from the culture of 30 or 40 years ago. And that was all planned, and they did it. And we're living with the consequences.
Yeah, the technology is moving so fast and it's hardly being scrutinised. But at least ITV have been having a look at one particularly worrying bit of technology, and I don't think that they even realise quite how worrying it is. And it's the idea of implanting microchips into people's bodies, into people's hands, so that they can use them for transactions, which is something which is hinted at anyway in the Book of Revelation. So let's have a listen to that from ITV from a few weeks ago now.
Could carrying credit cards, your house keys, or even ID soon become a thing of the past? Around 4,000 people in Sweden have already been microchipped, and some organisations say implants could be on their way to the UK. Is this the beginning of a bright future where chips will one day be able to diagnose and foresee health problems? Or is it a way to keep an ever closer eye on human movements? Rebecca Barry went to meet the pioneers inserting the tiny gadgets under their skin.
The city of Lund in southern Sweden dates back to medieval times. Over the centuries, it's witnessed plenty of change, but now there's a whole new sort of evolution going on. I'm here to meet some of the thousands of people in the country who are adapting their own bodies, who are inserting microchips under their skin. It means they may never have to carry a house key, train ticket, or bank card ever again. This is a microchipping party.
And applause, yeah.
Hannah's getting an electronic chip implanted into her hand. She believes one day we'll all be chipped like her.
So congratulations, Hannah.
Thank you.
You've been chipped.
Yes, I have.
How does it feel?
It feels good. I'm excited to see what I'll be able to do now.
Can I touch it?
Yeah, you can feel it there. I feel like this is the future. It's the next big thing that's going to happen. Happy cyborg birthday.
Happy cyborg birthday, yeah. To you.
Thank
congratulations.
But is this sci-fi fantasy or practicality? I want to know why anyone would want to do this.
Well, that's an episode which I put a link up to on our show page. Would you get microchipped on ITV? Although it's gone off of the ITV website now very quickly, Martin. The other thing, of course, is these little chips can cause cancer. Are you looking forward to your first cyborg birthday?
No. This kind of, you know...
But you're a Luddite, aren't you?
I'm not a Luddite, no. I'd be perfectly happy to use chips in my card, but why put it in your body? It's like tattoos. You know, you could put face painting,
well,
fine, but tattoos, no.
I'll tell you why you put it in your body, because you're going to get discounts from this, that and everything else if you do.
Well, until
see, but
they,
you'd
until yeah, but once
you've
you put
tempted,
it into your body, they may decide to change that policy. So there might be lost leaders. You get discounts to begin with, and then of course you can't escape from the debts when they mount up. I mean, basically, people. You know, it's just common sense, really. You shouldn't do things which are irreversible if you're not.
The point I'm trying to make here is very much connected to this 5G, which is a lot of this technology. There's no public debate about it. It's just rolled out, and actually, it's not tested either. No health test, that sort of thing.
Well, can I suggest to you, as I suggested in the first hour, that what may happen with all of this, if there is a crash, is that a lot of this technology will be shown to be unviable. That in actual fact it doesn't make money, people don't really want it, and it's actually, you know, people are basically really reasonably happy with the existing technology they've got, and they don't want a whole new set of stuff. That's the delusion, it's the boosterism of capitalism that says, well, people will want this, well, maybe they won't, and especially if they've got no money, they're not going to be interested in all this new technology.
Well, those that do have the money will. I mean, it's just like keeping up with the Joneses, isn't it?
Well, it is, but if you can't keep up with it, in the depression in the United States, when 25% of the population were unemployed, it wasn't keeping up with the Joneses, it's just putting food on the table. And that, and if there is a crisis, which I think is almost inevitable, then a lot of this boosterism of technology will just not happen. It just won't happen, not in the format that is currently being pushed.
BCFM. Well, time to have a look at vaccines now, and in a minute we'll have a listen to a clip from Andrew Wakefield, one of his recent talks. One of the things that irritates me is I keep hearing Andrew Wakefield, the discredited blah, 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 and so we don't ever hear anything from him anymore. The mass media have decided that he's totally discredited, and so to actually even listen to him, there's something wrong with that, and so we're going to listen to him because they don't listen to him. Because I can tell you, one of the things that I find is that he makes a lot of sense, Martin. I mean, there is an enormous force ranged against him. It's called GlaxoSmithKline, Bayer, and the pharmaceutical industry. And this has become an absolutely colossal lobby, hasn't it?
Well, it has, and I've got no brief for Big Pharma whatsoever. But I don't have enough medical knowledge to get into a deep argument about something like this. But Big Pharma, from an economic point of view and from a social point of view, yes, I mean, basically that's why NHS bills are ridiculously high, well, because they dominate the production of drugs. And the logical thing to do if you've nationalised the healthcare industry is you nationalise the pharmaceutical industry. And developing countries have been pushing for that for years. Why can't we just produce drugs? And they said, well, we wouldn't develop new drugs if there wasn't a profit to be made. We said, well, the whole thing should just be run as a public service.
Let's have a listen now to Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday, where our local MP Jacob Rees-Mogg, he also brought this subject up about certain drugs not being prescribed, and he's getting quite irritated about that. And in fact, he even got a pat on the back from the Speaker at the end of the answer.
Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. On the 15th of May, my right honourable friend welcomed a decision by NICE to allow the drug Spinraza, which is for spinal muscular atrophy, to be prescribed, including, we thought, to my constituent, the grandson of Mrs. Ogborne. NICE has now written to Mrs. Ogborne to say that they accept that the news story that appeared on the NICE website was not clear enough. That is code for saying my constituent's grandson will not receive this drug. When NICE says something, can it be ensured that it does it and that bureaucratic flannel does not raise people's hope then to doubt it?
Yeah. I say to my honourable friend, I'm very concerned to hear the case that he has brought before the House of his constituent. And in relation to Spinraza, I will ensure that this is looked into. If NICE says that Spinraza is available, then obviously it should stand by its word.
If the honourable gentleman doesn't get a result and he wants it to be debated again before the summer recess, let me tell him, it will be debated. He can be quite certain of that.
Well, that's the Speaker of the House, Martin, giving a big slap on the back for Jacob Rees-Mogg, maybe because of all this Brexit stuff that's going on in the background. But at the end of the day, there is enormous pressure to use certain drugs for certain things. And how confident are you that those decisions that are being made are not under commercial pressure?
Well, the NICE decision not to give this person this drug is presumably a cost decision, unless it's based on the fact that the drug is not really very good. But that's not, you know, a lot of these drugs may be harmful, but that's not what they were discussing there. This constituent of his wanted the drug, but NICE had just said, well, it's, we can't afford it. And that is rationing as a result of austerity, which Jacob Rees-Mogg has cheered to the rafters. It's just his constituent is now suffering from that. There you go.
The United States is ending religious exemptions to vaccine mandates for school children. So they have vaccine mandates in the US, but if you have a religious belief, then you can not have your children vaccinated. So we're talking about in the US every single child having to be vaccinated. And of course, we're also talking about scores, probably 50 or so vaccinations, which are now going to be becoming compulsory over there. There's many over here, but it's still not compulsory. It's a choice of the parents.
Well, Robert F. Kennedy's son in the US is very, very outspoken on this. I would prefer if we were to agree on a small number of vaccines, which was, you know, basically if the NHS controlled the production of vaccines, there would be any commercial reason to push them on the population. But don't forget, vaccines and all this stuff is run for a private profit, for private business. And therefore, it's in their interest to get people to take this stuff, whatever it is, statins, all these other things, because they're making money out of it. And the way to get rid of that is to nationalise it.
So
they don't make any money out of it.
Wired.com, as Wednesday briefing recently, so the date of that is just actually last week, European vaccine distrust is putting the most vulnerable at risk. European trust in vaccination is the lowest in the world, apparently. The Wellcome Global Monitor has revealed that Europeans increasingly distrust vaccines, with just 59% of people in Western Europe and 50% in Eastern Europe saying they think vaccines are safe, compared to 79% globally. So the Europeans don't trust vaccines. Why do the rest of the world trust them and not the Europeans?
Well, because if you live in rural India, where you can die die of all these measles and smallpox and all the other things, that smallpox has been eradicated.
Is it also possibly because they're educated people, better in Europe?
Yeah, well, they're exposed to more criticism of the vaccine programme.
And they're educated to be critical thinkers.
That's true, but it's also true that in poor areas of the world where people don't get much healthcare at all, if they're offered a vaccine by somebody for free, then they generally say, well, that's probably going to be useful to me. Now, I'm not. I think the US have just agreed that they won't in future use vaccine programs as part of their psychological warfare. Because if you remember, they claimed that they'd killed Osama bin Laden in Pakistan in Abbottabad by using vaccine people using vaccines as a cover. Now, okay. that brings the whole thing into disrepute beyond doubt.
Well, certainly when I was a youngster, measles was a very mild disease. I mean, I'm no expert, but now it seems it's not. Anyway, Andrew Wakefield, this so-called discredited doctor, gave a talk on that. I'll put a link up to the show page. Let's have a listen to a little clip from that now about herd immunity.
There's now been a resurgence of measles, which is entirely predictable. Most affected are under 1 or 13 to 24 and are recipients of 2 doses of the vaccine. Bear in mind, the mean age of measles during the period of natural measles infection was 4 to 5 years of age. So there's been this dramatic displacement in age of infection. So there is an accumulating number of susceptible people over time. We are becoming, as a population around the world, more and more vulnerable to measles. Herd immunity and vaccination. Vaccination has destroyed natural herd immunity. This is the important thing. Politicians need to understand that. This displacement in the age of measles to when it is more dangerous has come about precisely because of vaccination. It's not your fault. It's a very, very misguided policy that assumed knowledge of this infectious agent, which was totally inappropriate. Single exposure leading to lifelong immunity has gone. Passive immunity, this paper from France describes the dramatic reduction in passive immunity in mothers there. It's gone. Vaccination has made measles a more dangerous disease. And then we see this. Measles strikes back. It's the kind of paper we're going to be seeing time and again. This just happens to come from the Far East. Do boosters work? So the policy is, okay, well, let's just give more. Let's just give more. We have this remarkable situation, this irony, where you have a product which is a remarkable commercial success in terms of volume of sales, precisely because it doesn't work.
Okay, so maybe a little bit more on that next week. It's a lot more to say, really, with all these vaccines. Anyway, time to sign off now for the US-owned Comcast News at 8. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Our sister show Dialects here next Tuesday at noon. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
On the Hour, live from the Sky News Centre.